Questions?
The paradox is in the back here, the EPR paradox.
Yeah.
So, I can't remember. It was Einstein, I think, that was saying that like, so because, you know, well, there's no way of knowing that if you measure the one with spin up or spin down, that like the other one didn't already have the other spin, you know, and like that's not what causes the other one to have the spin, like the entangled state theory or whatever. But there was another experiment that I read about where they did diffraction instead of just measuring spin up or spin down of electrons, like through a single slit.
Okay.
And when they went through a single slit, it caused, had to have been double slit then, I guess. Maybe it was a double slit. But anyways, if you didn't measure the one, so they had two electrons interacting go in opposite directions, and then they went through double slit configurations. And if one was measured on the other side, then it would go through the double slit like a particle and show up as two bands. And if it wasn't measured, then it would go through and show up as a diffraction pattern.
So I'm unfamiliar with that experiment, and it seems unlikely. So what is certainly the case is if you don't have the two particles, you just have one particle, shot going through a two-slit diffraction pattern, and you detect which slit it went through, then you don't get the diffraction. Mm-hmm. So the further proviso that you're telling me about measuring back-to-back guys, I'm not familiar with.
Okay. Was I clear about what I meant, though? Like
I think so. So
setups kind of measure the one. And
yeah. So it's the usual sort of EPR setup where you have an entangled state that's created,
yeah.
And then you had some sort of double slit, and we measure something about that guy, and it affects the pattern here. I'm unfamiliar with the experiment. It would certainly be the case that if you measured that, you would affect what the other one was doing, but I don't see why that would affect the diffraction pattern. So I'd want
to... Well, that would be sort of like, I don't know, because there's the orthodox and then there's the, I don't remember what they called the other theory, but it would prove one of them kind of, wouldn't it? If that worked, I mean, if you measured the one that's going off to the right and then it causes this one to not go through as a diffraction pattern?
Well, what is certainly, so I don't know about the diffraction pattern piece of this, but I mean the EPR experiment has been done with spins, and there's no doubt how it comes out. It comes out with quantum mechanics. So Bell has his famous inequality that surprisingly having set but totally unknowable parameters is different from quantum mechanics, and basically theories which have the particle have some sort of in the sort of back-to-back case. If it had some sort of property like spin that you just don't know what it is, it turns out that those sorts of theories are ruled out.
Sorry, can you say that one more time?
Well, it's hard to say it in a concise fashion. So one way of kind of outing quantum mechanics is the idea is that there are hidden variables. So the electrons really, if we're repeating quote unquote the same experiment, we're not really repeating the same experiment, because in the second case they really are a little bit different because of some internal variable. So spin, of course, is one property you might measure, and so you might say that these particles really had some spin. We don't know which way it's going, but they really had some spin beforehand. And then when we measure this one, well, the other one is just following what it had to be. And it turns out that you can rule out that possibility.
You can rule out the possibility.
You could rule out that they had a spin before being measured.
Okay.
Because that's kind of what I thought this experiment would do, the one where it would, like, so basically it was two sets of double slits, and if you didn't measure the one on the right, then they both come up as diffraction patterns. If you measured the one on the right, then they both come up as, like, particle patterns. Like it was...
So I can certainly see the spin version of the EPR paradox, but I don't see how the version you're talking about would change the diffraction pattern. But it may be that I just don't know precisely what the experiment is.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing I read, it wasn't like a physical article or anything like that either. It was more like a popular science.
So Bell's inequality is a big... is a big player in this game, and I can print out some kind of surprising articles about all the things that it implies. But it rules out the possibility that these things have properties, you know, the way I have this piece of chalk, before they're measured. There's just no possible way that that can work. And what is surprising about Bell's inequality is that it could possibly make a difference. It's hard to see how having an unknowable quantity could affect anything that you would measure, right? Because you don't know it. But it turns out in the statistics, it does. And so delicate measurements show that any sort of case where the particle has a spin before it's measured is ruled out. And it's a pretty general theorem. So in order to have things like hidden variables, you have to go way around the block with weird sort of stuff in order to make it work. Which doesn't rule out the possibility that, that something way around the block is the case. But what Weinberg says is that quantum mechanics is really singular. That is to say, it turns out it's hard to make something that is a little bit like quantum mechanics and is accurate. That if you make something, if you try and change quantum mechanics a little bit, it turns out it changes lots of things, and therefore can be ruled out.
So basically, they haven't found any new theories that would agree with everything else that they've already found to be right, sort of thing.
So everything seems to be good with the original interpretation, and it's pretty clear that Einstein was wrong. Okay. Well, we already have his wrong equation, so. He was wrong lots of times.
He was right a lot of times.
Hindsight's 20/20, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, he also made corrections on his own. I mean, everyone makes mistakes, right? No surprise. The important thing is to make interesting mistakes. Other questions? So kind of the famous weird obsession for Einstein is that, you know, he spent basically from the 30s till his death on a unified field theory, which he never came close to completing and was probably barking up very much the wrong tree. So there were lots of people who were thinking that Einstein was kind of out of it after the 30s. Not in a bad way, but not along the mainstream. That not a lot of work he did after the 30s is of any interest today. So we had the big idea. Dirac's big idea is that we really shouldn't be particularizing position as being special compared to any other operator you might think about. And we have and we will continue to pretty much be saying that the wave function is this ket. But, you know, why is the position representative different from anything else? And his point of view was that it's not, right? So if we're looking at the components of some Hermitian operator using its eigenvectors, we get some set of components. Well, Psi of x is really no different. It's just psi where we have decided to write down its components in the eigenvectors of x. And so the eigenvectors of x, here's the equation. X operating on a function gives me a constant times that function. And the solution is that it's a delta function, and you can go to town on that and come up with lots of interesting and true ideas. But you don't have to do that. You really can continue to think that x is some sort of specialized position, and that's basically what we're going to be doing. We're going to be dealing with psi of x all the time. But you should have this idea of Dirac's representation theory. And you know, if we go that way, if we choose a different representation, then the x operator will look different. And it turns out that the x operator in the momentum basis is given by that equation. And it's worthy of note that no matter what representation you use, the commutator of the x operator and the p operator better be I h bar. We then spent a lot of time with a 2x2 Hamiltonian example, and you know, kind of the way we proceeded was we found the eigenvectors and values. We normalized those guys. We solved the initial value problem by writing our initial state, which we decided was that. Right, so these are the eigenvectors, and this guy here, of course, is just the overlap between the initial state and the eigenvector, right? That's Fourier's trick. And then if we wanted the time dependence of this thing to figure out where it is in the future, all we needed to do was to tack on the appropriate time dependences, and we were off to the races. And we could find things like, given this state, what's the probability that we would measure some other operator, some other sort of function with it. And the last thing we did was a bit of mathematics. We proved the CBS inequality. And I did bother to hit wiki, and Cauchy was in fact the first guy to do this. Bernicheski was the first guy to do this with integrals, and Schwartz was really a pretty late entry into it. So it seems wrong to do what our book does, which is to call this the Schwartz inequality. And all this is a statement, a generalized statement about how dot products work. Basically that dot products are going to be smaller than the products of the things that go into it. Questions? Okay, so plan is to finish up today chapter 3. We've got Heisenberg's uncertainty principles to show, and maybe along the way, this idea that classical mechanics is in some sense just the mechanics of averages. Right, so a particle doesn't have a position, and we can figure out that classical mechanics in some sense gives us the location of the average, but it doesn't show us the dispersion, the standard deviation that we have around that average. So what we'd like to do is to make kind of a direct connection between the equations of classical mechanics and the equations of quantum mechanics. And we've done that with particular cases, right? So we proved that the time derivative of the expectation value of x was just what you would call the velocity in terms of averages. And what we'd like to show is that these sorts of equations are true for any old quantity. That is to say, if we look for the time derivative of any old quantity, we would get basically the average value of what classical mechanics would say. So it's not too hard to start this. Let's take the time derivative of the average value of any old quantity Q. So if we don't bother to think like Dirac, what we think about is this average value is just this integral. And of course, the time derivative can hit the first term, it can hit the second term, it can hit the third term. So we just have to put all of those pieces together. Let me do it in kind of an odd order. So this is going to be the time derivative of psi q psi plus psi q time derivative of psi, and finally psi time derivative of q psi. So if you think about any physical quantity, I bet you can name angular momentum, momentum, angular velocity. The formulas for all of those things don't include time as an explicit thing, right? So we would only have something like this if we had a quantity that was equal to, say, x naught minus vt, right? So that explicitly has a time in it. X and velocity don't have those times in it. So typically this term is going to be zero. Maybe even always zero in this class, but at least typically zero. So what we've got is Heisenberg's, or the Schrodinger equation, which says that the time derivative of psi is 1 over I h bar times h psi. Now this side is complex conjugated, so when this I h bar gets, if in order for it to come out, we're going to have to pick up a minus sign when that I gets complex conjugated. So what we're going to get is 1 over minus I h bar, and then we're going to get h, oops, psi, oops, third time's the charm, h psi q psi, that's this term here. And this term, this I is going to come right out, so we'll just have cancel those minus signs. So this is going to be psi q h psi. And we have this term that's usually zero that's just going to go along for the ride. Remember that Hermitian operators can move from the left to the right free, right? So usually we would have to take the adjoint of something if we moved it like that. But for Hermitian operators, they go from the left to the right for free. So what we have here is psi hq psi minus psi qh psi. And I hope you see what we're getting here is the expectation value of the commutator. We good?
And why can the h go from being on psi to being on the
other? Because that's the definition of a Hermitian operator. So for any operator, I'll use q. Well, let's start differently. So psi q psi, this thing is by definition equal to the Hermitian conjugate of q psi. And the definition of a Hermitian operator is that q dagger is equal to q. Okay, so that's kind of how this is working in general. What are the operators that we're used to? Well, one operator we're used to is x, right? So sure doesn't make any difference whether x gets conjugated or not. Another operator we've dealt with was the derivative operator. And the derivative operator, when we used partial integration, it picked up a minus sign. So the dagger of derivative is actually minus the derivative. And now we can slap in some i's. So the dagger of 1 over I, well, when this thing gets complex conjugated, it's going to give us a minus I, and here we have this minus derivative. So apparently the dagger of 1 over I derivative with respect to x is itself. And that's, of course, the same thing as momentum if we multiply through by h bar. So momentum is a Hermitian operator. So it seems like a surprising feature, right? I mean, what would allow this thing to be the case, that the Q could be here or it could be there? If we look in terms of finite matrices, it's the same story. All that's required is that the matrix be Hermitian for MV dagger W to be the same as V dagger MW. I don't know if that helps or not. By definition, a Hermitian operator moves for free from the left to the right. And all of the operators that we care about, well, it's an overstatement, all physical operators are Hermitian. So examples of non-Hermitian operators are the derivative and the raising and lowering operator, right? The dagger of the lowering operator was the raising operator. So they weren't the same. Okay, so I don't know, true, perhaps interesting. How does this all catch up to classical mechanics? Well, we're not going to go there. So you started out with Newtonian mechanics with F equals ma, then you did Lagrangian mechanics where you were taking derivatives of the Lagrangian, and then you took Hamiltonian mechanics where you're looking at derivatives of the Hamiltonian. And they all, of course, give us exactly the same predictions. There are lots of ways of rewriting mechanics, and one of them is with what are called Poisson brackets, and totally in the context of classical mechanics, one can show that the time derivative of any quantity is that. So there's a formula, a huge correspondence between Poisson mechanics and classical and quantum mechanics. They're all the only difference is that we have averages. So one important characteristic of this is in classical mechanics, you're often interested in constants of the motion, right? Things that remain constant. And in classical mechanics, if the Poisson bracket of that quantity with the Hamiltonian is zero, and if we have the usual case where there's no explicit time dependence, then the resulting quantity is going to be a constant of the motion. Same thing for quantum mechanics. If the commutator of the Hamiltonian and Q is zero, then the corresponding quantity isn't going to change in its average value. So we're actually going to be pretty concerned with quantities that commute with the Hamiltonian because they have corresponding constants of motion. So we have the following kind of short proof. So if we have some quantity that commutes with the Hamiltonian, then of course what this is saying is that these operators are the same. And now we can have kind of an if-then statement. So if we have an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian, so if h psi equals e psi, then for free I can find another eigenvector of the Hamiltonian, namely phi, which equals q times psi. Because you can see that h operating on q psi, according to this equation, is the same as that. This thing here is e times psi. This is energy is just a constant, so it comes out. So if we have an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian, we can generate a new one for free just by using this commuting quantity. If we go back a year and a half to modern, try and remember the H atom, and we'll of course redo this soon, but we have this famous formula that the energy levels of the hydrogen atom are minus 13.6 eV divided by n squared. So n is the principal quantum number, but for any value of n, there were lots of states that would have exactly the same energy that are degenerate. Right? So for example, for n equals 3, we could have 5 d states, and we could have 3 p states, and we could have 1 s state. So there are 9 different ways of having states that have exactly the same energy, namely that correspond to n equals 3. Okay, so we can generate all of these states by, turns out, by angular momentum being the operator Q. H atom doesn't care about the orientation of space, which turns out, you remember from mechanics, to be equivalent to a conservation law. So we can generate new states by having the angular momentum operators operate on psi and produce, in the end, these nine various states. Okay, so I don't know, neither, that will all come back to haunt us. But we are going to be very concerned about things that commute with the Hamiltonian, because they're going to generate a whole sequence of degenerate eigenvectors. Okay, so how about Heisenberg's uncertainty? So Heisenberg's uncertainty was that the standard derivative, the standard deviation in x times the standard deviation in momentum was greater than or equal to h bar over 2. And we've never actually proven this formula, and we'd like to actually prove it and a zillion other formulas all at the same time. So what I'm going to claim is that the standard derivative, the standard deviation of any operator A times the standard deviation of any operator B is greater than or equal to the absolute value of h bar over I, the commutator of A and B. Okay. Oops, I guess I don't want this H bar. So one kind of surprising feature is that I. Why is that I there? And basically the answer is that there's always an I that's going to be generated by the commutator of any two Hermitian operators. So that there will be an I in here that'll cancel the I that's there. So that this quantity by itself is going to be real. Okay, so we've already seen that, right, commutator of x and p is, for example, I h bar. So the I is going to be canceled. I guess I want a 2 then here, don't I? And it'll turn out when we talk about angular momentum, the angular momentum in the x direction commuting with the angular momentum in the y direction turns out to give I times h bar and then the angular momentum in the z direction. So there always is an I that's in the commutator. And it's pretty easy to show that the commutator of A and B is pure imaginary. Right? So this I is going to cancel. And the proof is as follows, right? To show that something's pure imaginary, what I need to show is that its complex conjugate is equal to minus itself. So if I take the dagger, if I take the dagger of the commutator of A and B, so that's AB minus BA daggered, then you remember that when you dagger things, you reverse the order, just like you would for matrices, and these things are Hermitian, so that A dagger equals A. So this thing is in fact equal to BA minus AB, and that's of course just minus the commutator of A and B. Okay, so don't be concerned about this I. when push comes to shove, it's not really there. Okay, so how to prove this formula? Well, first thing, it's going to be easier to prove the square of this formula. So we might as well prove that. You can always take the square root for free. And the reason it's easier to take the square is you know that the standard deviation by itself has a square root in it. So by squaring it now, we don't have that square root to worry about. So the first thing may bother you a little bit. If it bothers you, the alternative proof is in the book. Without loss of generality, I'm going to assume that the expectation value of A is zero. So why can I get away with that without loss of generality? Well, I could always make an operator A prime that is A minus the expectation value of A, and that thing certainly has the same, that thing certainly now has expectation value zero. And it also has the same standard deviation, right? Because if you just shift things by a constant, you don't change the spread, which is the standard deviation. So it doesn't change this. It doesn't change the commutator because all you've done is subtracted a constant, a real number, and a real number commutes with anything. So I don't know. If you don't like that, you can carry along the A minus the expectation value of A, but it makes all the proofs look more complicated than is required. And similarly, without loss of generality, we can assume that the expectation value of B is zero. So with that, sigma A squared looks pretty easy, right? In general, this would be A squared minus A squared, but now this term isn't there. So sigma A squared times sigma B squared is just going to be psi A squared psi times psi B squared psi. And these are Hermitian operators, so I can take one of those A's and put it on that side, and I can take one of those B's and put it on that side. So this is A psi, B psi, B psi. And now, let me call this F, and let me call this G. So then what I have is something that's looking a whole lot like the CBS inequality. And we're guaranteed that this thing is greater than or equal to the absolute value of F G squared. So for a complex number, if I want to find the absolute value of z squared, I want to take the real value squared plus the imaginary value squared. And so what is certainly the case is the magnitude of a complex number is more than the real is more than the imaginary part of the complex number squared. Right? So it's guaranteed that this is greater than or equal to the imaginary part of FG squared. Well, how do we find the imaginary part of something? Well, if we have z minus z complex conjugate, then that's going to cancel out the real part, but it's going to double the imaginary part. So if I divide it by 2, I've got the imaginary part, but it's still imaginary, so I need to cancel out the I that's in there too. So this is a way of calculating the imaginary part of any complex number. Okay, so we can do that. So what we've got is 1 over 2i, this number itself, minus its complex conjugate. The complex conjugate just switches around the order. And now let's bring back my A and B operators. So F is equal to A times psi, and B is, G is equal to B times psi. Need a closing paren here. And again, Hermitian operator, so I can bring them over to that side of the equation for free. And you can see what I've got there is the commutator. Okay, so pick your favorite operator. We've shown this uncertainty relationship in the case of position and momentum. We've shown that this quantity here is I H bar, the I's cancel, and we've proven Heisenberg's uncertainty. If we look at the uncertainty in the angular momentum in the x direction squared, the uncertainty in the angular momentum in the y direction squared, it has to be greater than or equal to this commutator. And this commutator, we said, is that. So it has to be greater than or equal to the I's cancel, h bar over 2, the angular momentum in the z direction squared. Okay, so an infinite number of uncertainty principles have now been demonstrated just using this guy. But while I've proved an infinite number of uncertainty relationships, I haven't proved one of the famous ones. So there's that uncertainty principle, which is that the uncertainty in time times the uncertainty in energy also has to be greater than h bar over 2. And the reason I can't prove that is that there isn't a time operator. Time is a parameter, it's not an operator. It's an independent variable as opposed to something that's depending on x. So in order to have meaning for this thing, I have to attach some sort of meaning to what the uncertainty in time is. So kind of a classical application of this is that the particles have half-lives, so some of them decay, which doesn't mean that they all decay after one half-life. It means there's a range of possibilities. But the typical lifetime of a particle is its half-life. And so automatically, there's going to be some uncertainty in its energy, given that it has an uncertainty in its lifetime. And therefore, there's going to be uncertainty in its mass, because it's, most of its energy is in the form of its rest energy. But how do we go there? So uncertainty in energy is easy, right? The Hamiltonian is the energy operator, so I'm all set to make something work. But what do I mean by the uncertainty in time? So what we're going to argue is that what we mean by the uncertainty in time is how any quantity would be changing. So if we think about any quantity Q, it has some uncertainty, and it's changing at some rate. So the time it takes it to change by 1 sigma, that's going to be our uncertainty in T. So I'm going to interpret delta T to be that quantity. So that quantity is the time it takes for any quantity, in particular the quantity Q, to change by 1 standard deviation, and it was uncertain by 1 standard deviation, so that kind of represents the uncertainty in time. So if you accept that definition, what we've got then is that the uncertainty in time, Now, I'm going to put that in quotes because it doesn't exactly apply. The uncertainty in the Hamiltonian is now equal to the uncertainty in any quantity Q times the uncertainty in the Hamiltonian divided by how fast that quantity is changing in time. This guy here, I can apply my uncertainty relationship to, right? So this thing here is going to be greater than or equal to the absolute value of 1 over 2i, the commutator of Q and H. And we've just derived and erased the formula for the time derivative of the average value of Q. So the time derivative of the average value of Q, aside from the possibility that it has explicit time dependence, was just I divided by H bar HQ. So if we put that in here, so these guys are the same, particularly with the absolute value signs. The i's, of course, were never relevant because we were taking absolute values. So what we've got is h bar over 2. Okay, so I don't know if you necessarily have to like it, but we've proven this guy under the assumption that what we mean by the uncertainty in time is how any quantity Q is changing in time, how long it takes it to change by one sigma of that quantity. So the energy time uncertainty principle is kind of at a different level than the position momentum uncertainty. And we're, of course, doing non-relativistic quantum mechanics, so the expectation would be if we were doing relativistic quantum mechanics, x and t would be at the same level. And what you might hope is that t would become like x, and so we would have a strong version of the uncertainty principle. But unfortunately, it works the other way. In relativistic quantum mechanics, x becomes like t. And so both of these guys relativistically are in the same sort of quasi-state. Not quite so firm as you might hope. But non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which is what we're doing, we've got that guy for sure. And if you accept my definition of delta t, we've got that guy for sure. Questions? So done with chapter 3. So in the context of Newtonian mechanics, classical mechanics being the mechanics of averages, you know, kind of what are the differences then? And it might be worth pointing out that one kind of important difference is the following, and that is that the average value of the potential energy is not in general going to equal to the potential energy evaluated at the average position. And that's going to lead to differences between quantum mechanics. So for example, for a simple harmonic oscillator, the average position was 0, and so the potential energy was 0. But the average value of x squared was non-zero, and so there would be a term here. So this sort of deal, the fact that the average of quantities isn't the same thing as the quantity evaluated at the average, That's one way you get differences between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics. And of course, the other way you get differences is by the waves. And of course, for macroscopic objects, you know, if the potential doesn't change very much over a standard deviation of position, then this is a good equation. And so you will end up reproducing classical mechanics as long as things don't change much within the standard deviation of your material. Okay, so kind of what's next? So we've done all of this in one dimension, but we live in a three-dimensional world. So we'd like to solve some three-dimensional problems. And to some approximation, everything is the same, right? So we're still going to be interested in solutions to the time-independent Schrodinger equation, and we can expand any function in terms of that. Where are some of the differences? Well, one of the differences has to do with now, of course, we're going to be integrating over all space, and typically this is going to be, say, 1, and that means that the units of psi are going to change, right? So in one dimension, the units of psi were 1 over the square root of length, and now the units of psi are going to be 1 over the square root of volume. Well, it doesn't seem like a big difference. If we have things in three dimensions, then we have something that's new. We can have rotation. So we're going to spend a good bit of time talking about the angular momentum operator, which is, of course, just going to be the R operator crossed into the P operator. And the work we did with the simple harmonic oscillator is going to play the same sort of role. That is to say, we were able to solve the eigenfunctions of the simple harmonic oscillator just by using the raising and lowering operator. And the same thing is going to apply with angular momentum. So it's kind of a mess to solve the differential equation that is L squared equals a constant times psi. And it turns out that it's going to give us the Legendre polynomials that we remember from E&M plus more. But by using raising and lowering operators, we can get those same solutions kind of for free. So this seemingly bizarre trick that you can do things without doing things, do things for free, is true just as much for angular momentum as it was for the simple harmonic oscillator. So then, what's the list of potentials that we can solve? Well, the obvious one to start with, well, I don't know if start with is the right word. The one that we care about the most is the potential energy of an atom, where we have, and I guess if we're going to use MKS units, I should put my 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught in there. So we'll solve the hydrogen atom, and we'll come up with the spectrum that we previously described, right? So where the states are specified according to a principal quantum number, an angular momentum quantum number, and the sometimes called magnetic quantum number, the angular momentum that's in the z direction. Well, once we've taken care of all three-dimensional problems, you know, what next? The situations that we can solve exactly are few. So we won't solve all the solvable problems in this class, but there only may be another factor of 2 of solvable problems out there. So we need to talk about approximation methods. So perturbation theory, WKB theory, this in both time-dependent and time-independent formulations, and Rayleigh-Ritz version of it. So real problems aren't solved by algebra. They're really solved by computers. So we need to learn something about how those approximation methods work. Okay, I don't know why the bells. Funeral was today? We didn't get any notice. No. Let's quit. On to chapter 4 next time. So I'm being burdened by having to work all this homework that you've turned in. It's making my life miserable. I wish you would stop turning in this homework.
All right.
So remember the dentist. The dentist is coming in a week.
Friday, right?
Friday.